Welcome to the Messianic Message. I'm Kimberly Rogers Brown. I need to start this week's teaching with a correction of a script error I made last week, which I then read over while recording. I just read through it and didn't catch it. In speaking about Noah being drunk in his tent, I said it is not a sin to be a drunkard. That has now been corrected, but I want you to know that I know it is a sin to be a drunkard. Now, moving on to this week's Melchizedek teaching. The purpose of teaching you about Melchizedek is so that you will understand the role of Israel on the earth, how Israel was selected by Yahweh and why. It is a big deal to have the Creator of everything make such a selection as this, a people to rule and reign with Him once they learn to subject themselves properly to His authority. The roles of the order of Melchizedek and Israel are exactly the same, to bring the world to Yeshua, Yahweh Elohim. If you understand this, you will understand your role in Yahweh's kingdom, which is the order of Melchizedek, and why it is so necessary for you to do His will by keeping His commandments that Israel keeps failing at. And you will know what kind of government is about to set foot on the earth again to destroy the current wicked world government. This teaching is being presented as real-world information, as if we were there at that time, and not as commentary on ancient myths, which have no verifiable answers and which no longer apply, or as philosophies. The human Melchizedek king priests were real people facing real problems. We should put ourselves in their real-world shoes to get their perspective that the Bible is trying to tell us about, from which we can get a better viewpoint about the order of Melchizedek. To understand Melchizedek, we must understand Yahweh's plan for Israel from the beginning. We must understand what Israel is. Israel is a king, people, land. The king issues laws. The people live by those laws so they can inherit the land, which has a capital city, Jerusalem. And this is not some future situation. The nation of Israel, not to be confused with the modern UN-created political state of Israel, is a nation of laws that governs her people worldwide and has done so for 6,000 years. They, or we, have been ruled by Yeshua Yahweh Elohim's heavenly Melchizedek kingly throne all this time. Yeshua said His kingdom is at hand. What that means is that the very fact that there are people living like there is a king with authority to command their lives is what makes His kingdom Israel, biblical Israel, not the current state of Israel, a reality on the earth. Biblical Israel and the current state of Israel are not the same Israel at all. In the first two parts of this series, I provided details about the line of the human Melchizedeks and their functions. If you have not listened to those, please do. I will now move forward with the next appearance of the Melchizedek in Scripture. Let me first provide a historical background for the conditions of Terah's and Abram's world. There are scant details about life in the following centuries after the flood. Genesis 10 provides only genealogies, and Genesis 11 gives us two accounts of Yahweh's intervention on the earth because of how quickly things were sliding south. There are three men to take note of from Genesis 10, Nimrod, Elam, and Eber, or Eber. Two of these men's progeny will be faced by the sons of Eber in the end of days. We need to know who they are and their motivations for wanting to kill the descendants of Eber, because they tried to kill Terah's family from the beginning. Terah was Abram's father, and Eber was his fifth great-grandfather. This very small history will give us a clue of what and why we are still facing Nimrod and Elam today. Within the first two generations after the flood, the family of Noah began to migrate south from the eastern Turkey mountains of Ararat to settle in the fertile delta between the two rivers of the Tigris and Euphrates that emptied into the Persian Gulf. Each descendant of Noah would have staked a claim of land and built a settlement that eventually became a city. Population growth brings with it the need for governance, so these cities became city-states, governed by a king who led the people to worship the very same demons that had instigated the corruption before the flood. This is why Yahweh called them Goy, Gentiles, nations. Out of the shoot they returned to wickedness. So the word Goy or Gentile carries with it the attribution of being automatically wicked until one decides to repent and return to Yahweh. One of the first city-states to grow into a small empire was Elam, the physical firstborn of Shem, Genesis 10:22. Another builder of city-states was Nimrod. One city was not enough. He built four, Babylon, Uruk, Akkad, and Calneh, in Genesis 10:10. But let's start with Shem's son, Elam. Shem was the Melchizedek after Noah, and Elam, being the physical firstborn of Shem, probably expected to become the next Melchizedek with all the blessings and authority given to the one holding the office. This wealth and authority requires the office holder to be humble, walk in the commandments, and obedient to Yahweh's laws. Otherwise, there will be a huge mishandling of resources. Brethren won't be cared for, and the wicked Melchizedek, should there be one, would line his own pockets and wreak satanic havoc on the earth instead of bringing righteousness. Elam must have failed the character test, because Shem would pass that office to a descendant in Arphaxad's line, Abraham. Arphaxad was Shem's third-born son. During the lifetimes of Terah and Abraham, wars were fought between Ur and the Elamites that greatly affected the entire region and shifted the axis of power from Sumeria and Babylon to Egypt. Sumeria's narrow width was divided between the borders of what today are Iran and Iraq. Notice on the map the red circles around the names Elam and Ur. Ancient Elam was in the southwest area of modern Iran. Elam, according to historians, put the finishing touches on the city of Ur from where Terah fled with his family. Elam later populated the Persian and Media empires, which later became Iran. Perhaps already you are beginning to see how what happened in the beginning will need to be finished in the end. The ongoing battles between Elam and Ur were not accidental. There were descendants of Eber, from where the word Hebrew comes. From extra-biblical accounts, history, and archaeology, we also know that Ur was a city of idolaters. But there was one among them who was not, Abram. Elam's damage to Ur was such that Terah moved, or, might I say, fled his family from their home in Ur to Haran. Genesis 11, verses 27 to 32. Genesis 11, 28 says Terah's son Haran died before Terah. When I was learning the history of this time period, the thought occurred to me that Haran may have died in battle with the Elamites. Did Haran die protecting Abram? Did Terah flee Ur to protect Abram? Genesis says nothing about this, nor is it ever hinted at anywhere else in Scripture. The point for us to realize from this story of Abraham's family perhaps being chased out of Ur is that this pattern will repeat in the end of days as Iran chases Abraham's children around the planet, forcibly converting them to Islam. Remember, the patterns go backwards as well as forward. What will happen in the end that we don't have details about from the beginning could be very similar. But this time, there will be nowhere for Abraham's descendants to flee to except to the protected wilderness of the first Exodus in southern Jordan, according to Revelation 12:6. In this coming Elamite-Iranian-Islamic-Shiite caliphate is Abraham's grandson and Jacob's wicked twin brother, Esau. His descendants are well known to be part of modern Iran. Esau's grandson, Amalek, was a population within the Persian Empire, and one of its members was Haman, who tried to kill all the Jews. Now to Nimrod. The Sumeria city-states built by Noah's sons and grandsons existed before Nimrod built his own cities from which to rule and reign, Babylon, Uruk, Akkad, and Calneh, Genesis 10:10. Akkad was the city-state that turned into the Akkadian Empire. Its emperor was Sargon, who many historians believe was Nimrod. Of special note was Sargon's war against Ur. The Akkadians were thought of in Ur as hunters. Nimrod is mentioned as a mighty one and mighty hunter, Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9. He was said to be the first tyrant as a mighty or gibor hunter. The suggestion is that he hunted people, perhaps for sport, but more likely as a great warrior. Being a great warrior is how Sargon is remembered. Akkadia was not only interested in destroying Ur, it was interested in becoming an empire ruling over many subjugated city-states. Some historians say Akkadia was the first empire on earth. Some say Sumeria was the first empire and Akkadia the second. I agree with those who list Akkadia as the first empire because Sumeria was not ruled by one sovereign. Each city ruled itself and they each made war with each other over territory and wealth. Akkadia was the first to create among men the sovereign vassal covenant structure that Yeshua Yahweh Elohim used from the time of Adam. Let me elaborate. The order of Melchizedek is a unique governing model created before the foundation of the earth was laid. The order of Melchizedek is eternal. Its founder, king, and high priest is Yeshua Yahweh Elohim. This is the governing structure of the earth from the beginning with Adam through all of his successors listed in Genesis 5 and Noah who went through the flood. It is this structure that Satan is imitating starting with Nimrod. Satan, in this wicked mimicry, is the sovereign. His vassal was Nimrod. The point of all the wars from the time of the flood forward is to bring about this imitated order of Melchizedek's structure in Satan's hands. Do you now see why it is so important that we Israelites understand this order of our king's making? There will be one covenant structure with a sovereign and vassal kings ruling over people when this is all over. Satan wants himself to be the sovereign. We know, because we have read the end of the book, that Yeshua will be sovereign and we will be his king priests. What Nimrod accomplished with Akkadia in Sumeria is returning to the earth right now. His Akkadian Empire ruled across Mesopotamia, the Levant, and Anatolia, modern Turkey, sending military expeditions as far south as modern Bahrain and Oman. It is the Levant, the area from where Shem's descendants will rule and reign, that Nimrod wants most. The Sumerian language was supplanted by the Akkadian language. The Sumerian language disappeared into oblivion until a Sumerian tablet was discovered at the city of Ur ruins by Leonard Woolley in 1927. When the first academics in London saw the clay tablets Woolley brought to them, they didn't even think it was a language, but some sort of primitive method of counting inventory. Nimrod's descendants won't be satisfied with the destruction of the holy language, Hebrew. He wants the total destruction of all Shemites, all descendants of Shem. Unfortunately, there are Shemites on the earth today who are cooperating with Nimrod's agenda. They are now ruling from Jerusalem. Nimrod's Akkadian Empire is still with us today in the ancient empires of Assyria, which is now part of Iran, and Babylon, which is now in Iraq. Both of these are prophesied to do much destruction in the end of days, as in the beginning, so in the end. Babylon will not rise from its ashes in southern Iraq. Rather, it will return to the earth through Jerusalem, because the Jews do not know who Israel is or what Israel is, and their dogmas found in the Talmud and the Kabbalah come straight out of Babylon and Egypt. The destruction wreaked by the Elamites and Akkadians finally collapsed all of Samaria's city-states. In the wake of that destruction arose Egypt. In the hands of Egyptian priests, the newly created demon worship was further developed into Egyptian mystery religions. Yahweh said throughout the prophets that the Israelites never forgot Egypt. The atrocities they committed against Yahweh were perpetrated by their continuing to practice Egyptian mysteries along with the religious rites of the surrounding nations. Egypt will return as the mystery part of the Jewish mystery Babylon in the end of days. The Jewish Kabbalah is based on the ancient Egyptian mysteries. The fall of the West will be like the fall of Sumeria, with invasions and destruction, famine, followed by disease and death. Now, this short history was important because we Israelites must understand that coming full circle is what was on the earth in the beginning. If that destruction was so hideous in the beginning, imagine what it will be in the end. The books of Daniel and Revelation, along with the other prophets who prophesy about the end of days, try to describe it for us, but we really don't understand the utter destruction we face. Perhaps getting a little understanding of what happened in the beginning and then multiplying it by hundreds or thousands will help us get it. Now, to Abraham, who lived in what is now southern Syria, in a city called Haran, the same name as his brother who died in Ur. After Terah died, Yahweh told Abram to leave Haran in Genesis 12:1. I can imagine that both Terah and Abram wrestled with where to go to improve their situation. I can also imagine that while Terah was guided by Yahweh to leave Ur and head south rather than follow the main migration patterns north and east, it was Abram who was commanded by Yahweh to continue south to the promised land against the normal migration pattern of that time. The fifth and sixth words in the scroll of Genesis 12:1 are lek lek. The word lek means walk in most instances. It is the root of the Hebrew word halakha, which means our faith walk. But its first use is in the description of the river Hiddekel, which was one of the rivers flowing out of the Garden of Eden. Genesis 2:14 says, "And the name of the third river is Hiddekel. That is it which, or lek, goes forth toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is Euphrates." So the first use of lek is to flow like a river. Does living water come to mind? Does water covering the earth come to mind? We should understand that Abram is being associated with living water. It was Abram's job to go occupy Shem's inherited territory that Canaan, Ham's cursed son in Genesis 9:25, had usurped. There is an important word in Genesis 12:3, venefricu. It is translated in English as blessed, but it is much more than blessed. It means grafted in. Genesis 12:3 says, "And I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you, and in you shall all of the families be blessed." Venefricu. The Hebrew word nevriku is the nephal conjugation of the root word barak, which is the way that Strong's translates it. But it is more than just blessing. Rather, it means mixing or grafting. In Hebrew, Genesis 12:3 literally reads, "V'nefriku b'ka kol mishpachot hadama." In English, "I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, and in you all the nations of the earth shall be mixed." Yahweh's method of overcoming the damage done to the earth in just the first few generations after the flood was to put all the nations of the earth with Abraham's family. They, the nations, will be mixed in with Abraham's family by the process of grafting, like grafting tree branches onto one trunk. This is why Abraham was selected. He rejected idolatry, according to the book of Jasher, which made him a proper successor to be the next Melchizedek after Shem, his ancestor, going back eight generations, Genesis 11:10-26. Genesis 11:10-26 ends with Abram because he was the next in line to be Melchizedek. The first order of activity upon hearing Yahweh's words is obedience. Abram moved, taking with him a large entourage of people, some of whom he likely evangelized, while others were from his own family. Abram's wife and his nephew, Lot, were among those who moved into the land, Genesis 12:25. Genesis 12:10 says, "And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land." Abram was familiar with famine, having left Ur during a mass migration of people moving north and east out of Ur and the other city-states of the collapsed region of Sumeria under the failed rule of Akkadia. There was another reason for the famine, besides all the wars. The soil had become saline. Wheat crops that once grew plentifully in Sumeria no longer grew at all. Even the barley that once tolerated saline soil also became scarce as the salt content continued to rise. Today, nothing at all grows in this region. Call it nature or divine intervention. Either way, Abram was forced to move to the promised land where he could have succeeded the king of Salem. But it wasn't that Yahweh wanted Abraham to succeed Shem as the Melchizedek. Rather, Yahweh was now in the process of selecting a special people, a Hebrew nation of Israelites who would come from Abram and would, for a time, emphasize the patriarchs and their children. Noah's other progeny had risen through Nimrod. Now, Mitzrayim, or Egypt, had succeeded the Sumerians and Akkadians as the regional power. Mitzrayim, Egypt, was now following in Nimrod's sovereign vassal model, stolen from the order of Melchizedek. Canaan had become a vassal of Egypt, and possibly tribes living in the Negev close to Egypt. There were unfettered tribes in the north, four of which would create an alliance of their own to raid the promised land, Genesis 14:1-2, and it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedar Laomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. These kings were from the hangers-on of the fallen Akkadian Empire. Note that one king was from Shinar, the other from Elam. These are the same areas that still trouble the region today. The ancient Sumerian-Akkadian region, poor as it was, saw that the Jordan Valley plain was rich. The Elamite king had subjugated the five city-states of the Jordan Valley for 12 years, according to Genesis 14:4, and the four kings of Sumeria, Akkadia, attacked the five kings of the Jordan Valley when they rose up against their overlords in Genesis 14:5. The Elamite king, Chedorlaomer, led his coalition against the city-states of the Jordan Valley. In the process, Lot was captured. The Elamites have fallen and risen in history and will rise again. They are adept at making coalitions. Amraphel, the king of Shinar in the region of Iraq, was in Chedorlaomer's coalition. Iran has made a coalition today, the 4+2 coalition, which includes Iraq. You see, the patterns don't change. Daniel 11:40-45 describes another such incursion of the Iranian Elamites into Jordan and Israel in the near future. The Elamite king of the north destroyed the Jordanian king of the south and plundered the city-states of Sodom and Gomorrah, according to Genesis 14:11. Well, Abram heard about it in Genesis 14:13, and there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. Abram, the descendant of Eber or Eber, and bearing Eber's reputation as Eber-like, Eberu, finally had enough of Shinar and Elam. He went after them and won the battle in a type and shadow prophecy about Yeshua doing the same in the end of days. Genesis 14:14-16. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants born in his own house, 318, and pursued them to Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them to Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. The servant of Yahweh prophesies of those whose hands are trained for war by Yahweh in Psalms 144:1. Abram's hands were trained for war. He chased the wicked kings of the north all the way to Damascus. This city will play a major role in the end of days. Actually, the current war around Damascus will become the West's defeat. Notice that Abram came back with his rewards, like Yeshua will come with his rewards. Isaiah 40:10 and chapter 62:11. Most assuredly, Abram's defeat of the last vestiges of the Sumerian Akkadian city-state was both supernatural and immensely satisfying. In a sense, Abram avenged his brother Haran's death in Ur, whether or not Haran died in a battle there. This act of valor and upholding one of the elements most dear to the order of Melchizedek, with the possibility of laying down his own life for Lot, got the attention of the Melchizedek. It was the right thing to do, and Abram's reward was that he received a blessing from the Melchizedek. Faithfulness to family is a major component of our faith, but not to just any family. Faithfulness to our family, who are also in covenant with Yeshua Yahweh Elohim, as Lot undoubtedly was, according to Peter in 2 Peter 2:7-8. The definition of family will be expanded as time goes on to include everyone faithful to Yahweh in the congregation as Mishpachah, and then as the body of Messiah. Both of these include people we do not know, but whose testimony is their faithfulness to the covenant. Yeshua would later explain that family and friends who are against our walk do not receive our loyalty in Deuteronomy 13:18. Genesis 14:17 says, "And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, Abram, gave him, Melchizedek, tithes of all." Abram was greeted by the defeated king of Sodom, but the more important meeting was with Melchizedek, king of Salem. This was Shem, the human Melchizedek counterpart to Yeshua Yahweh Elohim at the time. People confuse Shem with Yeshua and Yeshua with Shem when they look into Melchizedek. Today, the focus is on Shem, the king of Salem. The human Melchizedek line began with Adam, came down to Noah, then to Shem, and now Shem will bless Abram as the next intended successor to the office of Melchizedek. The Melchizedek's blessing was not a regular blessing. Abram was greeted by the priest of the Most High God with an offering of bread and wine. These are always the elements associated with Yeshua, Yahweh Elohim, the heavenly Melchizedek at that time, and who has now obtained also the human mantle of Melchizedek through his life, death, and resurrection in a human body. I hope that clears up some things for you about the identity of Melchizedek in the past, in the present, and in the future. Melchizedek recited that the Most High God is the possessor of the heaven and earth, and stated that the Most High God had delivered Abram's enemies from Shinar and Elam into his hands. This was divine intervention and Shem's signal that now is the time to make the selection and name the intended successor. Abram would die before taking office, but Shem would likely have passed the Melchizedek torch to Isaac, who would have passed it to Jacob. We don't have record of this, but the passing of the Melchizedek office to Jacob is hinted to us in the tithe he promised to Yahweh, just as Abram did, tithing to Shem. Abram paid tithe from the spoils of war to Melchizedek. This was a reciprocity with important significance. It meant that Abram recognized Shem not merely as an ancestor, but as the earthly Melchizedek and by extension the heavenly order of Melchizedek and his place in it. The tithe at that moment became symbolic of a transaction between the earthly Melchizedek and the heavenly one. Thus, Jacob's promise to pay tithe to Yahweh for bringing him back to the land as he escaped from Esau's clutches carries the same connotation, Genesis 28:22. Abram confirmed his oath to Yahweh to the king of Sodom, who asked for the return of the people and told Abram that he could keep the spoils of battle. Abram replied that he would take nothing except what his men had eaten during that time, because he had sworn to the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, Genesis 14:22. If Abram had kept the spoils of battle, he would have been subjugating himself to the king of Sodom. It would have been like Abram saying that he won the battle, not Yahweh winning it for him, and the spoils were his. The remaining spoils were to be returned to the king of Salem, so he would come to know the God of Abram instead of the other way around. The role of the order of Melchizedek is to bring people to Yeshua Yahweh Elohim, and Abram was adept at making this clear. This event precipitated Yahweh in Genesis 15, expounding on his former promise in Genesis 12:2 to Abraham, to make him into a great nation. Genesis 15:1. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am your shield and your exceeding great reward." Yahweh spoke to Abram in war terminology, shields and spoils or rewards, suggesting that a greater reward than the spoils of the battle to recover Lot was in store for him. For the first time in Scripture, Abram speaks to Yahweh, asking how it can be that he will be a father of a nation when he has no sons. The idea is that there needs to be a successor, and more importantly, there needs to be a successor from Abram to pass the Melchizedek office to. Yahweh explains that Abram will have a successor. Abram at that moment believed Yahweh, and Yahweh counted his belief as righteousness. Genesis 15:6. Why did Abram believe so willingly? Well, first, he had just been through a supernatural battle. against the mighty kings of Shinar and Elam. Second, after Abram believed Yahweh, it was further explained to him that it had been Yahweh who had brought Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees. This would have been proof enough to Abram that Yahweh's hand was always on him. The escape from Ur had likely not been a small event or an easy one. Abram again replies back to Yahweh, asking how he will know for certain that Yahweh will keep his promise. This is not a lack of faith, but a real act of faith, such as we take today when we ask someone to seal the deal in writing. We believe them, and we want to have proof that we can carry with us. This is where the foundation of Yeshua's gospel message began. Genesis 15:9. And he said to him, "Take a heifer 3 years old, and a she-goat 3 years old, and a ram 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon." And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, and laid each piece one against another, but the birds divided he not. And when the fowls came upon the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell on him. And he said to Abram, "Know of a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve I will judge. And afterward shall they come out with great substance. And you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp passed between those pieces. In the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, "Unto your seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, and the Rephaims, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites." The smoking furnace and the burning lamp are Yahweh the Father and Yahweh the Son walking through the pieces while Abraham was in a dark trance state in Genesis 15:12. This ritual would have been well known to Abram as to its meaning. The odd thing was that Abram did not take part. The smoking furnace and the flaming lamp made the covenant between themselves on behalf of Abram and his seed. It is here that Yahweh promises a seed that will be the one who makes Abram into a great nation. Abram, the father, will have a son who will fulfill all the promises. Yahweh, the father, will have a son who will fulfill all the promises. What promises? The implied promises made when two kings walk through the split and bloody animals. This is the covenant of the pieces. It was the most important and binding covenant anyone could make with someone. Kings going into battle would make this kind of covenant so they would know the other would not turn on them in the fight. And if one of them did turn, then he would die this kind of bloody death. It may be that the covenant of the pieces foreshadowed drawing and quartering in old Europe. It was extremely serious to make this covenant and not uphold it. Abram didn't make this covenant. Yahweh made it with Yahweh. The meaning of it is that Yahweh himself will die if Abram's descendants, his seed that will populate Israel, breaks the covenant. Abram's seed, Israel, did break the covenant, and Yeshua came to die for that. The gospel message, death for restoration. That's the gospel message. Death, followed by restoration, began here. Yeshua, Yahweh, Elohim, promised his father, the sovereign king, that he will die for Israel. The heavenly king, the king and high priest of the order of Melchizedek, made that promise. We have already seen that the human Melchizedek counterparts fall short, starting with Adam. It will be that the heavenly Melchizedek will also need to become human in order to take on himself the human role as well. He did that. In this covenant, on behalf of Abram, in Genesis 15, there is a king in Genesis 15:17. That's the burning lamp. There's the land in Genesis 15:18-21, and the people in Genesis 15:13. The seed, Israel, is king, people, land. This is prophesying about Israel and all that the king will go through to create a righteous people to populate his holy nation to be a kingdom of priests, according to Exodus 19, verse 6, and 1 Peter 2, 9. Genesis 15 is the crux of the character of Melchizedek, Yeshua, Yahweh, Elohim. He is the only king to ever rule on earth who was willing to die to restore his people. No other earthly king ever died for his people. Now, some have died in battles trying to get more people to rule over, but none ever loved his people so much that he died to save them. That is our Melchizedek from the order of Melchizedek. This is why Yeshua is the priest forever after the order of Melchizedek in Psalms 110:4, in the chapter where Yahweh spoke to Adonai, where we have another picture of the two as Echad, Elohim. The smoking furnace and the burning lamp are the same as the two, one speaking to the other, in Psalms 110, verse 4. The next event came in chapter 16 when Sarai gave Abram her concubine, Hagar, the Egyptian. This union resulted in Abram's son Ishmael being born. It turns out, though, that Yahweh doesn't need our help, and sometimes our help seems like it makes things worse. Every year during the Torah cycle, Sarai is castigated for her part. All kinds of negative things are said of her. Let me give you a different perspective. In the ancient Near East, wives were required to provide children for the husband. Abram loved Sarai and did not cast her out because she didn't provide him children. Upon hearing that Yahweh said Abram would have a son, Sarah's first thought would likely have been that she needed to get busy. I call this obedience, not interference. She was past childbearing, but had a handmaid who was still in childbearing years. Logically, this was her best option. She had not given a concubine to Abram for childbearing all through her life. Perhaps that was because she wanted Abram all to herself. You see, Sarai probably loved Abram as much as he loved her. But knowing the will of Yahweh would have spurred Sarai into obedient action. And people say, and even I have said, we are still dealing with Sarai's mess to this day in the form of Ishmael. However, I now think those words are misplaced. Let me tell you why. It is because Ishmael will enlarge Yeshua's kingdom in the end. He knew what Sarai would do, and after it was done, Sarai kicked Hagar and Ishmael out of their home, and he promised Hagar and Ishmael that he would be a great nation. Is it a coincidence that Ishmael had 12 sons like Jacob? You see, Yahweh could have told Abram right then in Genesis 15 that Sarai would bear him a son. Abram would have told Sarai, and she probably would have still laughed at the notion, but this information may have helped her to not give Hagar to Abram. Could it be that Yahweh wants this son and his progeny? The answer is yes, or Yahweh would not have promised Ishmael to be in his kingdom. The Genesis 15 covenant now requires a sign. All covenants require some kind of token of reciprocity. The nature of contracts is that there is a list of things the seller agrees to do in exchange for money or services or products. The basic and most important difference between a biblical covenant and a modern contract is the expiration date. Covenants have no expiration. Contracts designate an expiration date. The token or sign back to Yahweh for all of Yahweh's promises made to Abram and his seed is the cutting of the foreskin. The circumcision is required for the promised son, which Abram has not yet fathered, to come through. The seed of Abram must pass through the cutting to qualify as the promised son. This formalizes Abram's seed as being like Abram, a Hebrew, Eberu-like. We will later learn that circumcision is only complete when the heart follows the physical sign. Physical circumcision makes you a Hebrew. Heart circumcision makes you an Israelite. Both circumcisions are required and will be enforced in the coming kingdom. Genesis 17:1 says, "And when Abram was 90 years old and 9, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be perfect.'" Abram must follow in the footsteps of the character of Noah, who was Tamim, perfect. Noah was the Melchizedek at the time of the flood. Shem is now in that office. No doubt Shem's character was also Tamim, or perfect. This is another way we know Abraham was to be the next Melchizedek. But unlike the previous Melchizedeks, Abram would be the father of many nations. He would be the grandfather of the man whose name would be changed from Jacob to Israel, the name of the nation from before the foundation of the earth. But the other nations would be grafted into Israel through Yahweh's ingenious immigration program. That program includes physical and heart circumcision. And here's the brilliant part. The native citizens of Israel, who are natural-born sons of Israel, will get circumcised on the 8th day of their lives. They will come in physically and later in life be required to circumcise their hearts. The nations, however, will be required to circumcise their hearts first, and then later circumcise their flesh. This latter pattern is the way Abram entered into relationship with Yahweh. Heart first, flesh second. Genesis 17:4. As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. In Genesis 15, the covenant was not with Abram. It was on behalf of Abram and his seed. This covenant is with Abram and his seed, and now he will no longer be called Abram, but Abraham, because he will be the father of many nations. Genesis 17:5. And in Genesis 17:6, he says, I will make you exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings will come out of you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God to you and to your seed after you. And I will give to you and to your seed after you the land where you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Sarai will no longer be Sarai, but Sarah, because she will be the mother of many nations through her one and only son. His seed will beget one almost 2,000 years later who will become the eternal Melchizedek, Yeshua, Yahweh, Elohim. Abraham obeyed, and all the men of his house were circumcised, including Ishmael, in Genesis 17:25-27. That's right. Ishmael is a Hebrew. In the end of days, his descendants will circumcise their hearts and be accepted on Yahweh's altar. Isaiah 60:7. They too will be saved. This has been Kimberly Rogers Brown from TheMessianicMessage.com. Thank you for listening.